Being Programmed to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica, with your host, Jimmy Fallon Gong.
This is Premium Episode 23, Q&A 6, Y2K, The Lincoln Assassination, Ferguson, Freemasonic Basketball, Crime Novels, and the Cultic Milieu. Today I'm recording from Yonkers. For my long-term listeners who have asked Q&A questions in the past, I have not forgotten about you. I have not been the greatest at juggling premium episodes, interviews, and Q&A questions. And don't even get me started about the episode naming conventions. Like, I had a system that I thought made sense, sort of only makes sense to me in retrospect. Listen, I'm good at certain things, but not others. What can you do? That said, I have not forgotten about these questions, and I'm going to knock some out today. You'll have to forgive me if they don't all turn into episodes or even series-length treatments, like novels as Spycraft. It's not because these questions aren't good. They are great, in fact. Let's get into some now. Anthony asks, don't know if this is too late to ask, but I was wondering your thoughts on the whole Y2K scare. The people who seemed to take this seriously and or coined the term all seem to have some level of involvement or interest in economics, finance, and banking. These include people like John Koskinen, Michael Mandel, and Dave Eddy. Do you think that the whole Y2K event could have been used as a way for wealth transfer? And what does that possibly say then about the supposed year 2038 problem? Now, I think that's an interesting question, especially because the figures Anthony called out are not who I was expecting. When I was just looking at the question in general, I was thinking that he was going to call out some of the, like, more out there conspiracy type people, but the people he cites, like he said in the question, are not particularly kooky. They all have this high-level interest and or involvement in the fields he cited. I think in the case of Dave Eddy, the motives are probably pretty straightforward. Like, he ran a consulting company that stood to make a lot of money. Michael Mandel is an economist, and that's kind of like being a sex worker in that you're for hire, right? To me, John Koskinen is the most interesting of the three that Anthony mentioned. Koskinen had an interesting career because he grew up in Ashland, Kentucky, of all places. He went to Duke, then went to Yale, then went to Cambridge, and then served in a bunch of positions that look, to me, like grooming in the general sense, not the, you know, sex abuse specific sense, grooming him for executive positions in the future. Like, he's appointed president of the U.S. Soccer Foundation. Like, come on, man. He was in some cabinet positions in the Clinton administration, and he headed up the President's Council on Y2K. Later on, he would serve on the board of a utility company. He would also, I think, be the head of Freddie Mac. He would later be appointed IRS commissioner. Like, this is one of those classic career non-politicians who goes between corporate boardrooms and high-level cabinet positions, sometimes some NGO stuff, right? But, I mean, there's lots of those guys. Right, and I didn't get, like, super spooky vibes per se. But, I mean, if we're talking Y2K here, in the words of Winston Churchill, never let a good crisis go to waste. If we speculate on all the different types of purposes the Y2K scare might have served, I'll be honest with you, if there was wealth transfer, I didn't hear about it, or I don't know of it, right? Not to say it doesn't exist. Maybe, you know, people more informed than me could, you know, tell me, but there, of course, is the possibility that there was a general, you know, strategy of tension type trauma, like freaking people out about an impending apocalypse type of thing. I'm sure that's part of it for a certain extent, because they did sort of manufacture this fear and then it got way overblown. I think a lot of that could be attributed to journalists doing what they do best, if it bleeds, it leads type of coverage. Like, anytime someone predicts an impending disaster, it can be newsworthy for certain journalists some of the time, especially if it's experts predicting it, right? But, and again, I may be out of my depth here, or I'm just speculating, but what types of changes occurred due to Y2K? Allow me to read from an article entitled "John Koskinen Helped the U.S. Brace for Y2K, and in doing so, changed federal IT." The article quotes Koskinen saying, "On New Year's Eve, we had 100 information desks set up in the Coordination Center. Madeleine Albright, who was then Secretary of State, came by and said, 'Geez, you could run the whole world from here.' Koskinen said, 'Well, we might have to.'" Now, my words here, I am not privy on specifics of command and control systems used by our federal government, but I cannot help but imagine that they might have used Y2K as a pretext to consolidate, centralize, update, and improve things. And what I am suggesting here is not even particularly nefarious, right? I mean, there's a crisis, it's partially manufactured or, you know, blown out of proportion, and then you use it to fix various problems, right? It's almost like spring cleaning or something. This is well within the realm of the believable, I believe. Maybe someone with more experience or who has read more on command and control systems could clue me in, but I imagine this probably took place based on what I have been able to read. Then the article continues, citing Bruce McConnell, senior cybersecurity counselor at the Homeland Security Department and former Y2K council member, saying this was the first major problem that federal CIOs had to work on together, and that experience continues to serve today as CIOs deal with cybersecurity, information sharing, or moving on the cloud. That sense of collaboration that John achieved has helped the community continue to work together." Unquote. So, what sort of collaboration and community do you imagine that federal CIOs felt? What were they working on together? Do we know precisely when PRISM was implemented? PRISM, of course, for those who don't know, was the widespread NSA data collection program that Edward Snowden, you know, made us privy to. Now, I'm not saying that they already knew that the Patriot Act was coming down the line, but wait, yes, they absolutely did, in fact, because they wrote it ahead of time. Janet Abrams, executive director of the Y2K Council, finished up saying, "IT continues to give the capacity to do things faster, more efficiently, and more effectively. It's important for IT leaders to continue to focus on making information available to the public as soon as possible. We want to be at the cutting edge. It's tough, but if I were a CIO, that's what I would be focused on." Unquote. The bleeding edge, perhaps. Now, I know it's not directly related, but I would like to bring up, by way of examples, a pre-PRISM look at one particular instance of mass surveillance in the pre-digital era. That would be the United States' surveillance on Puerto Rico. For an island of 4 million people, the FBI kept carpetas, or secret police dossiers, on at least 100,000 Puerto Ricans. 75% of these were dossiers of a political nature. These files grew to include nearly 2 million pages of information. The average file was about 20 pages, and it could include school transcripts, employment history, religious practices, political affiliations, club memberships, bank accounts, property holdings, taxes paid, family and marital records, travel history, auto registrations, license plates, meetings attended, publications written or received. They also included personal information, friends, business partners, sexual partners, mistresses, gigolos, debtors and creditors, personal letters, intercepted at the post office, obviously, recorded phone calls, photos, wedding lists, laundry tickets, and miscellaneous items. Would you like to know when this program started? It started in 1935, and it went on well into the 1980s. I think there is realistic reason to imagine that the program never actually ended, for Puerto Rico specifically. Now, this wasn't just collection of data, or the ever-euphemistic metadata even, right? Carpetas would be used specifically to sow disruption and discord into the Puerto Rican independence movement, according to a J. Edgar Hoover memo. My contention is that Puerto Rico may have faced more COINTELPRO-style disruption tactics than the rest of the United States, but I imagine that that level of data collection, or at least something close to it, was not limited to Puerto Rico. And I know just enough about the NSA to know that PRISM was not where this all started. Y2K was probably an excuse they used among, like, different departments to break down and force down objections, bureaucratic walls, and move in the general trend towards the acquisition and consolidation of data across all of these different silos, right? These different departments. That is my contention. As for wealth transfer, I would be really interested if there was an angle for that too. I'm sure there was. I'm just not familiar with it. But the stuff I cited just now about Puerto Rico, you can read about that and the general repression of Puerto Rico in the excellent book, The War Against All Puerto Ricans by Nelson A. Dennis. Look at that, a question in under 15 minutes. What a world. All right, so we have Molly Ringwald who asks, so what's the deal with the Lincoln assassination? I mean, there's something there, right? Obviously there was a plot, everyone knows that. There was a conspiracy, in fact, to kill the president, right? But aside from that, we know that John Wilkes Booth was actually in a secret society. Or I believe it's believed that he was. That secret society was the Knights of the Golden Circle, which was sort of like a, I want to say, quasi-Masonic Confederate secret society. Their dream, what they wanted to accomplish, was to create a slave confederacy that would extend well into Latin America. Now, I'm extremely interested in the Knights of the Golden Circle. I am interested in Albert Pike, who was involved in Confederate intelligence. I've brought him up several episodes now. He created the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. Pike corresponded with Giuseppe Mazzini, the Italian revolutionary, as well as Eliphas Levy, the French occultist. Pike was a very interesting guy. I have aspirations to look into the weirdness surrounding the Civil War one day, but we'll see. I'm not there yet. For one thing, I've got the Japan thing going. For another, I'm not old enough yet. I feel like you can't really get way into the Civil War until you reach a certain age. You know what I'm saying? We'll see. Now, I'm not necessarily sold on this theory, but my favorite book, mostly joking, Dope Inc. has a whole theory about the Lincoln assassination. I think, personally, it would be really instructive to sit down and cross-reference what's written in Dope Ink with Dave McGowan's essays on the Lincoln assassination, and cross-reference it with mainstream historical books. I think that would be really instructive. But since this is a Q&A, I will stick just with the crazy part today. Now, mind you, I'm not fully signing off on this, but I'm going to read a few paragraphs here. B&I Byrith effectively managed its operations with another branch of the Scottish Rite based in the Midwest and the South, the Knights of the Golden Circle, the forerunner of the Ku Klux Klan, the training ground for the entire Confederate military and political leadership. Its most important American operative was Judah P. Benjamin, a British subject and leader of the B&I Byrith, whose amazing career included a brief term as Confederate Secretary of War and then Secretary of State during the closing phases of the Civil War. Another British subversive agent later worked with Benjamin to found the Ku Klux Klan. He was Dr. Kuttner, B&I Byrith leader and grandfather of Bernard Baruch, a leading Wall Street Anglophile. Their colleagues in that venture included Confederate General Albert Pike, a Grand Commander of the Scottish Rite, and a Jesuit priest. The same group carried out the Lincoln assassination, which raises questions concerning the Defense Department's refusal to release secret files concerning that assassination. My words here, side note. The Defense Department denies that they have secret files concerning that assassination, though as of the writing of this book, I believe there were still files classified. Would love to look into that specifically as well, but I continue reading. The B&I Byrith and its Confederate opposite numbers, the Knights of the Golden Circle and the Ku Klux Klan, were only three of the many parallel operations that Lord Palmerston brought to life during the 1860s. In Britain, future Prime Minister Disraeli, the man who evaded debtors' prison through the help of the House of Rothschild, launched the Young Englanders. In Italy, the local leader of the Scottish Rite, Mazzini, organized and commanded Young Italy. Scottish Rite member and Rothschild agent Alexander Herzen initiated a similar group covertly, avoiding the watchful eyes of the Tsarist secret police. His best-known protege took the name Bakunin. In China, as of the Second Opium War, the long-established Triad secret societies had already taken the retail distribution franchise for the distribution of British opium imported from India, and had become an uncontrollable paramilitary arm of British free trade. Order of Zion leader Judah P. Benjamin was the individual who gave the order for the Lincoln assassination, according to one authoritative historical document in the public domain, the report of the judge advocate assigned to investigate the assassination, and report to the military commission responsible. The report cites the orders of Confederate General Jefferson Davis and Judah Benjamin. According to this document, Confederate secret intelligence raised a dirty tricks slush fund of $649,000 through the sale of Confederate bonds in Liverpool. At the time, the headquarters of this outfit, called the Secret Cabinet, were housed in St. Lawrence Hall in Montreal. In the same building occupied by the Commander-in-Chief of British Forces in Canada, General Sir Fenwick Williams. The report names George N. Sandys as the group's money mover. Sandys was an American citizen, formerly an advisor to Democratic presidential candidate Stephen Douglas, and consul of the United States in Liverpool under the Pierce administration. 8 days before Lincoln's death, the chief of the secret cabinet, former Interior Secretary in the Buchanan administration, Jacob Thompson, withdrew $180,000 from the group's account at the Bank of Montreal in Montreal to set the murder plot in motion. His courier was John Harrison Surratt, a British agent trained at Jesuit Georgetown College. Neither Thompson nor Benjamin was ever apprehended. Both fled to England and remained there under the Crown's protection. This evidence, heard on June 25th and 26th, 1865, ran up against a cover-up effort under the direction of Secretary of War Edward Stanton that compares in audacity to the work of the 1963 Warren Commission. The relevant document is not available to researchers. The documents relating to the Lincoln assassination are still locked up in the archives of the Defense Department. Jefferson Davis, who lived comfortably in Montreal after the collapse of the Confederacy, kept his papers in the Bank of Montreal, the same bank that conducted the funds for the assassination itself. If they are still in the vaults of the Bank of Montreal, the bank has not acknowledged this. These facts concerning the death of President Lincoln are more than a useful case history, illustrating the power of the dope trade's criminal networks. If the leads developed in New Orleans District Attorney Garrison's investigation of the Kennedy assassination were accurate, the two murders were the work of the same operation. All that is necessary is to cross out the names Secret Cabinet and Judah Benjamin and write in Permendex and Major Lewis Bloomfield. From what remains of the official record, there is no question that the death of Abraham Lincoln was traced to British-controlled and British-funded networks by American military intelligence. It must be underscored that much more than the central figure of Lord Palmerston brought these networks into the main line of the narcotics traffic. Southern cotton, for which British verged on invading the United States during the Civil War, was not merely a facet of the same trading operation that produced the dope trade. For all purposes, it was the dope trade. Opium was the final stage in the demand cycle for British-financed and slave-produced cotton. British firms brought cotton to Liverpool. From there, it was spun and worked into cloth in mills in the north of England, employing unskilled child and female labor at extremely low wages. The finished cotton goods were then exported to India in a process that destroyed the existing cloth industry of India, causing widespread privation. India paid for its imported cloth and railway cars to carry the cloth and other British goods, etc., with the proceeds of Bengali opium exports to China. Without the final demand of Chinese opium sales, the entire world structure of British trade would have collapsed. Palmerston's above-cited remark concerning the future of British trade in opium-consuming China and other parts of the world was, in fact, a matter of hard contingency. Unquote. Now, my words here. Although the conclusions drawn here are sound insane, and perhaps they make the case a little too neatly, a little too tightly, a little too strongly, that the Queen is the world's drug kingpin, I like that they draw the line between these things. Like, Britain did help the Confederacy, not enough to win, but enough to weaken the United States. We know that cotton was in fact sold to the British to be, you know, manufactured in British mills. I really love the sentence where they say Southern cotton wasn't just a facet of the dope trade, it was the dope trade. Like, this is deep stuff. We already had a global trade, right? Like, drawing the line between the destruction of the Indian textile industry, the slave trade, growing cotton, like, child labor, like, making the clothes, like, and then, obviously, the opium trade. Like, these things were all intertwined. And Lord Palmerston said they were. So, like, why are we sitting here acting like they weren't, you know? Like, very, very interesting stuff. Now, as to whether the British ordered the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, I'm not going to go on the record and say that. But I would not be surprised if they were involved. That's what I would say. And I would love to research this further. Short answer, the plot was probably more widespread than is believed by official narratives, as these things often are, and the whole story was probably much weirder. Evan asks, request to do a deep dive on Ferguson protest leaders dying in violent, mysterious ways. Real question, are the cops running murder squads like the LAPD gangs? Thanks. The short answer is yes they are, and yes they do. Other than that, I am not going to do a deep dive on Ferguson protest leaders dying. On an unrelated note, have you heard of fusion centers? I will quote from the Department of Homeland Security website. Fusion centers are state-owned and operated centers that serve as focal points in states and major urban areas for the receipt, analysis, gathering, and sharing of threat-related information between state, local, tribal, and territorial, and federal and private sector partners, unquote. Fusion centers are the local arm of the intelligence community, which, allow me to remind you, includes 17 federal intelligence agencies, as well as state and local and private agencies, or units, right? Going off of what we know, and mind you, that's just what we know officially, the DEA has been getting intelligence tips from the NSA since at least 2012. You can draw your own conclusions about whether that started in 2012, but the implication that the NSA has the ability and does listen in on the drug trade, the implications of that will make your head spin, right? Now, on the DHS website, there are 78 known recognized fusion centers. The whole point of them is to interact and interface with local law enforcement for counter-terrorist purposes. According to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which no, we do not have time to talk about them, public records requests regarding fusion centers in Massachusetts showed that fusion center officers, quote, monitor demonstrations, track the beliefs and internal dynamics of activist groups, and document this information with misleading criminal labels in searchable and possibly widely shared electronic reports. The documents included intelligence reports addressing issues such as internal group discussions and protest planning, and showed evidence of police contact, unquote. Now, I am not being cute. I'm not implying that fusion centers specifically ordered Ferguson activists to be killed. But, let's see here. Tracking the dynamics of activist groups, and then, what's the quote here? Possibly widely shared electronic reports. I mean, the way these things work, right, fusion centers would have played a role in identifying these people, and then whoever might have killed the activists would have probably used that information. That's just, like, almost indisputable, right? And I like how Evan phrased the question, bringing up the Ferguson protest leaders and bringing up the cop murder squads, particularly the gangs, right? If you look at how the police operate in Latin America, where things are not that different, but there's more transparency in the sense that we know how these things work, a lot of paramilitary death squads would simply be police and special forces just moonlighting, right? Using the information they got from their, you know, day job to go do things at, you know, at night. I think it is fair to speculate on these lines. I do not think that it is wise to do so publicly, if that makes sense. But I am not saying people shouldn't talk about it. In fact, people should talk about it a whole lot more. I think you just, everyone should probably be careful about what you say, however.
I remember getting intimidated and busted at age 13 by the police. I remember my friend Tate Bryan shot in the back in Tampa, Florida for his first offense burglary. I remember the police firing into crowds and killing children because they were the wrong color. I remember the narcs in my high school trying to set me up for a big fall. I remember the police bringing dogs into our school and sniffing away my rights. The police is the Klan, is the mafia, and they're all on the police state, and they're out for me, and soon they're going to be out to get you. So you better get going if you know it's good for you, and take your stand. I remember when I first went to school and said, don't be a joker, don't be a fool, pledge your allegiance to the red, white, and blue. Those things got you to nothing for you to say, fuck all of you, only had one. Watch them die in the heat of sun, stuck on the bullet of a policeman's gun, nothing I can do but stay away. In the USA, you gotta take a chance, they plan on staying free. They say it's the land of living, they're trying to make a dead man out of me. I remember when I first hit the road, I worked for the lens of the money I owed. Came to offer and knocked my door, crossed before, now I'm running some more. City to get me ain't happened yet, burning my fingers, last cigarette. It's time to remember, it's time to forget, nothing I can do but get away. To the USA, I gotta take a chance, plan on staying free. You call this the land of the living, they're trying to make a dead man out of me. I remember, I was starting to hurt how a man's supposed to be about as free as a bird. Close in prison, folly dead, meantime live with a price in my head. Wonder if there's a place to be, oh I told you a fellow like me. Name's the paper, face on sea, nothing I can do but get away. In the USA, you gotta take a chance, plan on staying free. They call us the land of the living, they're trying to make a dead man out of me.
Sheen asks, I don't know if this is the right place to put this question, or if it's something that interests you at all, but my question is, what's the deal with basketball and Freemasonry? The sport was invented by a Mason. You got that video of Shaq with the enormous Masonic ring, and apparently he works as part-time law enforcement in Miami these days. And if you look it up, there have been a lot of famous basketball players who were also Freemasons. Some Masonic sites even claim Michael Jordan. I'm not saying there's something sinister going on, but I would be interested in your thoughts on whether there are esoteric roots to the game of hoops we all love. And of course, if there is anything sinister going on, then your thoughts on that, please. Great question. Basketball does have some interesting ties. I would say baseball is probably the most transparently Masonic game, but I don't think it is not. There aren't a few aspects of it in basketball as well, like there are, is what I'm saying. I am ironically pretty ill-equipped to talk about most team sports. I just haven't played a lot of them. I've watched almost none, but I'll give it a try. And unfortunately, I didn't find a whole lot more than what O'Sheen brought up. But I will say, first of all, that, you know, Shaq might be a Freemason, and that's sad. I'm still a fan. No, I don't want to hear if he's actually sus. That would break my heart. I do like Shaq. Like I was saying, I haven't found too much more than what O'Sheen mentioned in her question, but for those who don't know, basketball was invented by James Naismith, who was a Scotch-Canadian. I spent time trying to nail down if they were Scotch-Irish. It appears that they were not, but they were Presbyterian. Naismith attended McGill University. You know, that's my favorite school. Was he a Freemason? Yes, in fact, he was. He first joined the Freemasons in Massachusetts, Springfield specifically, in 1894. He went on to achieve the rank of Worshipful Master, and he was active in Massachusetts and Kansas, where he later moved. Like O'Sheen said, there are a lot of prominent basketball players who are Freemasons. There's Shaq. I think the next most famous one would be Scottie Pippen. And I just did not get very far, mainly because I just don't know enough about basketball, unfortunately. But I did find some hilarious sites that compared basketball to basketball, like B-A-A-L, like the Levantine entity from the Bible, right? And the same website argued that the seams of a basketball made a Nero cross, or a broken cross, which is pretty close to like the peace sign, right? I'm not necessarily sure I buy either of those, but you know you're on good territory when you're looking along those lines. I will say this, I do have Freemason content coming up soon. I would be interested to revisit this basketball question once I actually know a whole lot more about Freemasonry, which will be hopefully soon. So maybe we'll circle back. BTR asks, would you be willing to expand on Son of Sam and your views on Mari Terry's book? For those who might not know, the Son of Sam refers to the infamous Son of Sam slayings, which were carried out allegedly by David Berkowitz around the New York City area. And the book that BTR mentioned would be Mari Terry's book, The Ultimate Evil by Mari Terry. I have read it. I am sold on the idea that Berkowitz did not act alone and that there was a broader network at play. I am not necessarily sold on which network that was and the specifics of what Terry argues, if that makes sense. And I'm not an expert, so I'm not saying I know more than Mari Terry, right? A lot of what this opinion comes from is Ed Opperman. Always like to plug him. He has a lot of episodes discussing the case, as well as The Farm, and particularly George at Cavdev, who is a guest on The Farm. And so, Ed Opperman has talked about a bunch of different angles with a bunch of different guests. I think George sort of pointed at something called the Great White Brotherhood, which sounds remarkably dark. I am going to choose my words carefully here. I think that there was something to the Process Church of the Final Judgment angle. However, I think some of those networks are still quasi-active, and I would like to hold off on discussing it in detail until I can nail some more things down. So basically, I would say it's worth reading. Most of it is focused on arguing that Berkowitz wasn't acting alone, which is valuable. I'm not sure I would take as the gospel truth all of the conclusions and the direction he takes it, but maybe he's right. You know what I'm saying? It is not a solved case, I would say. So, the user Non-Euclidean Cutie asks, question, what the fuck? Listeners, I was just assaulted by a bug that flew at my face. We'll see if I keep that in. Crazy things happening in the studio today. Question for Program to Chill. What are your 1-3 top I want to believe but there is little to no proof theories of parapolitical history? And this user gives by way of example the theory that Barbara Bush is Aleister Crowley's love child, or that Justin Trudeau is Fidel Castro's son, etc., etc. Now, I like this question. It's interesting and entertaining. I find it difficult to answer because this is not how I typically think about these things. Like, when I was younger, I did used to curate zany conspiracy theories for fun, but that's not how I approach it anymore. And I'm not saying that OP is, you know, bad for asking me, because it's a fun question. I will go through maybe a couple of these theories. One that I am particularly fond of is the theory that Ron Howard, the child star, actor, and director, like he was in The Andy Griffith Show, Happy Days, a bunch of films that he's directed, like Apollo 13, I think, maybe being the most famous, I don't know. He's directed a bunch of films. You know what? I don't need to explain who Ron Howard is, right? The theory is that Ron Howard is the love child of Jean Spiegel Howard and Nikita Khrushchev. Now, I want you to pause the episode. Pause the episode. Pull up a picture of Ron Howard. Present day is fine, because present day Ron Howard and Nikita Khrushchev, put their pictures side by side. Tell me that's not uncanny. Eh? Hmm? Now think about this. They say Ron Howard was born in 1954. However, in the old days, you could just falsify, you know, birth certificates. Like, it was like nothing, right? Now, Nikita Khrushchev visited the United States in 1957. To say nothing of the possibility of Jean Spiegel Howard, you know, traveling abroad, obviously. She was an actress. Hmm? Now, what's more, Ron Howard, his ostensible father, Rance Howard, served in the U.S. Air Force around the time that Ron Howard was born, or was said to be born, right? Now, Rance Howard, he served in Special Services, which was a unit that provided entertainment for the U.S. military. You know who else was in Special Services? Allow me to go down the list. There was Burt Lancaster, Mickey Rooney, the known Satanist Sammy Davis Jr. There was the big band leader Glenn Miller, Pete Seeger, Desi Arnaz, Clint Eastwood, Burl Ives, Don Knotts, Leonard Nimoy, Dick Van Dyke, and many, many, many more. And like, all these guys were enlisted and serving in that particular special services, right? Now, I ask you, did Rance's wife get knocked up by Nikita Khrushchev? I'll tell you this, I don't have any evidence that it didn't happen. But I will also tell you this, I invented that theory, it's completely made up, I have no proof. You know, like the years of almost line up, and the special services thing is interesting, but I don't really have any more to go on, right? So that's one I made up. But as for two other theories, like, I had to think for a while on this. It's tough because as a simple podcaster, I feel like I regularly find stuff so batshit insane that it's hard for me to, like, do the opposite and, like, pin down a theory that I think is really entertaining that isn't true. But here's one. I can't confirm this or deny it, but I am fixated on the idea of James Jesus Angleton. For those who don't know, he was head of CIA counterintelligence for, I want to say, over a decade, maybe even 2 decades, a really long time. Anyway, the idea that Angleton was a Soviet mole, that is extremely funny to me. Lord knows I have spent so much time thinking about it, and I've read at least 3 books on Angleton. Like, James Jesus Angleton is maybe one of my favorite topics for anything. And the idea that he was a Soviet mole, while that maybe sounds outlandish, similar things happened in Great Britain. Like, it isn't actually that impossible. Different factions in the CIA actually came to this conclusion. There were different reports written. I personally kind of lean against it because Angleton probably did so much evil shit that didn't seem to be helping the Soviets. But it would be really funny if it were true. So that would be one. Another one that would not be very fun, but I am sort of fixated on the possibility of it being true, would be the idea, according to, like, Monarch lore, which is to say the, quote, like, extended universe of MKUltra lore, which is to say stuff that is not well cited, but unfortunately, technically within the realm of possibility. The idea in, like, Monarch lore that Bob Hope, the celebrity, was some kind of evil Pizzagate-style sicko. Using, you know, brainwashed sex slaves, that type of thing. Now, I wouldn't want that to be true, but this ironically kind of touches back on the whole special services unit idea, because Bob Hope, at least towards the end of his life, was famous particularly for constantly doing USO tours, United Services Organization, which is where, you know, they'll get celebrities not in the military to go overseas and, like, do shows for the troops, things of this nature. And maybe one day I'll do, like, a longer thing on Bob Hope, but Bob Hope was born in London. His father was a stonemason. The family emigrated to the United States, and Bob Hope, like, worked in, like, vaudeville, basically. But in this, like, showbiz era, he worked with Fatty Arbuckle. Arbuckle, of course, was almost certainly guilty of, like, rape and manslaughter. So the idea that Bob Hope might legitimately be some kind of sicko actually kind of holds, given that he literally, like, worked with one. I mean, that's not to say that everyone who works with, like, predators is a predator, but, like, it's interesting, right? There are also, like, it's well known that Bob Hope was, like, a pretty bad womanizer. There's also some weirdly likely rumors that he was a bigamist at one time. And Bob Hope was friends with Walter Winchell, one of the journalists I'm obsessed with. So he might very well have been spooked up earlier than the USO tours. Which is interesting. It's one of those things where even if the Monarch stuff proved to be, like, not literally true, it was, like, onto something. It could be one of those things where, like, it was written based on a certain familiarity with real operations, almost like maybe a Pizzagate type situation. I mean, Pizzagate in the limited, narrow sense, right? Very interesting. Might have to revisit Bob Hope one day. Connor asks, "Hey Jimmy, favorite crime novels, both as art and as a means of understanding a given time and space?" That's another great question, and I've said before I would like to do more literary content. I have made no secret of my love in particular for Roberto Bolaño, as well as James Ellroy, and for both of them, I've read almost everything they've ever written. I think maybe that's literally true for Bolaño, and it's pretty close to being true for Ellroy. Bolaño, of course, is not typically considered a crime novelist in, like, the strict genre convention, per se. But we all know those genres don't necessarily matter in a strict sense. But several of Bolaño's novels would pretty much fit in a loose sense. For those who don't know, Roberto Bolaño was a Chilean poet and novelist whose famous works include The Savage Detectives and 2666. His works, like, convey, like, this subterranean sense of dread that accompanies periods before and after crimes take place. He doesn't always necessarily depict crimes or violence, but, like, I've never read anyone who can convey that sense of dread, if that makes sense. It's hard to explain, but, like, reading his works can give you, like, this anxious feeling of suspecting but not knowing, like a paranoia that is not acute, but, like, a paranoia that emanates everywhere, gets in everything, almost like smog from maquiladoras or something. James Ellroy, on the other hand, is completely different. All of his novels are intensely physical, almost cartoonish. They have caricatures of masculinity, but within those caricatures are weirdly fleshed out and well depicted, like, three-dimensional men. James Ellroy is obsessed with making many iterations of the tragic, emotionally damaged, yet romantic cop, or sometimes criminal, or sometimes PI or detective. And you would think that he would run out of ways to make iterations of that same character, but he doesn't. Like, there are endless iterations on these different guys who are, on paper, not that different from each other, but they are extremely different when you actually read the novels. So the LA Quartet is probably some of the rawest, best noir, not from the original wave of noir, but, like, you know, the updated school. I don't necessarily recommend Ellroy if you don't have a strong stomach for racial slurs or, you know, certain types of bigotry. Not to say that Ellroy himself is, in fact, I would argue the opposite, but he's depicting cops in, like, the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s. So, like, none of his characters are, well, most of his characters are probably not good people in a certain sense. So just know going into it that there's a lot of not PC language, right? But the Underworld USA trilogy, I argue, is legitimately as good an insight into the world of feds, criminals, and spook operators in terms of depicting their actual day-to-day lives and how it intersects with something like the whole Bay of Pigs thing, to quote Blauer, quoting Nixon, right? Hard recommend, but only if you're into it. If it doesn't sound appealing, you know, don't give it a try. But everyone should read Bolaño, probably. Another one that I have mentioned, and I still have aspirations to do an episode on him, is Jean-Patrick Manchet. I'm still finishing the last of his crime novels. I've read probably 4 or 5. They are all very good. They are all very noted on French deep politics, but most importantly, they are all intensely entertaining. They're economical, they're quick reads, they're written in a style like as if Hemingway were less concerned with his dick and his mortality and more concerned with telling a good crime and or spy story. I also like Daniel Woodrell. Probably his most famous work would be Winter's Bone, which was adapted into a movie with Jennifer Lawrence starring a couple years ago. I think Winter's Bone might be my favorite of his works too. It depicts a very bleak world in the Ozarks in more or less modern times. It sort of explores the more or less petty organized crime in the Ozarks as, you know, a young adult is forced to, like, travel the criminal underworld, right? It's very well written. I also enjoyed his Bayou trilogy. I love True Detective. Season 1 and 2. Haven't watched 3 yet. I know. I'll get to it. But I've read Nick Pizzolatto's Galveston novel, and I will argue, it is not bad. It's pretty good. It is probably, well, I guess there's one or two elements that could be viewed as noided, but for the most part, it's a fairly straightforward crime novel. Pretty competent. Strikes a lot of the same notes as the True Detective series, unsurprisingly. Two that maybe people haven't heard of would be the two Cuban crime authors, Leonardo Padura Fuentes. He wrote a quartet of detective novels which are set around a particular, like, homicide detective in Havana in, like, the 90s, maybe late 80s, early 90s. The quartet, it's really good. It was also adapted into 4 movies, which are on Netflix, which are also pretty good. So, now, the other author I haven't read yet, but I'm excited to. It's Pedro Juan Gutierrez. He wrote what's known as the Havana Sucia trilogy, the Dirty Havana trilogy, which I have not gotten to read yet, but I'm very excited to. People have said that, like, you're not really into a genre unless you like the mediocre or subpar, you know, entries into the genre. And that's true for me. Like, I listed off a lot of the good stuff, but, like, I like even decent or bad crime, whether it's in movies or TV or literature. I know I've trashed on sci-fi and fantasy, and I do not recant any of that, but I do, believe it or not, respect these different genres of fiction. Like, I know sci-fi has the power to imagine worlds that end up happening. I know fantasy offers, like, both escapism and some sort of idealism that you can strive for. That's probably not always a bad thing. Horror can tap into parts of our brains and really, like, interrogate why we're afraid of certain things. But I think crime in particular is, like, almost like an x-ray on society. I mean, a lot of noir almost explicitly makes that clear, right? Nothing cuts down to the fundamental truth of society and life like a good murder mystery. And just like in real life, how many times do real-world plots boil down to, like, literally some actually incestuous rich asshole running some arcane real estate scheme? Just like Chinatown, right? That's, like, real life, man. Allie asks, not sure where to put this, but an episode on Burning Man would be super cool. I am with you there, though I will say, there are certain topics I would just as soon tap on subliminal jihad to cover to do better. And I would pretty much argue that most stuff in California falls into that camp where they would probably be able to cover it better. Like, for example, not California related per se, but, like, they just did an improv episode and I was so happy they did that because I really wanted to know, like, what's up with improv. I did not want to do the work to figure it out. And I feel that way about Burning Man. I'm certain there is both some really boring yet shady financial and tech stuff happening, and probably some weird occult stuff too. I'm just ignorant on so much of the basics of California, or I'm less familiar with it than people in California, maybe would be the right way to put it. So it's almost like I end up having to do extra work. Like, even really dumb stuff, like California geography, man. Like, I don't know what's near anything. It's almost embarrassing. Non-Euclidean Cutie, yet again, asks, another one for the Q&A. Do you think there's anything to the growing idea that space is not real, at least as we are typically told, and or that standard physics is also a deception? No. You know, I just brought up subliminal jihad. I would probably plug, again, their episode on the Copenhagen deception, because it really articulated a lot of things that, like, I was thinking about quantum physics that I didn't really have the background to articulate. So I would recommend checking that out in terms of, like, quantum physics being a deception on a certain level, an ontological op, to use their phrase. And the guests that they have on are excellent too. As for standard physics being a deception, and, you know, getting back to the question about space being a deception, or not real or something, I will say, for my part, and maybe this isn't what non-Euclidean Cutie wants to hear, you know, no disrespect at all, I would say, personally, I don't like a lot of the, like, bong-rip mindfuck stuff that starts to go along these lines, like suggesting that the moon isn't real, that space isn't real, things of this nature. I didn't like it before I started researching Jack Sarfati and his kooky quantum physics. I didn't like it before I started researching Velikovsky with his catastrophism, his new chronology, the idea that history isn't real, right? But now that I have researched both of those guys, I have a whole lot more context as to why this is bad, basically. I think that a serious, extended look at two previous communities can give us a lot of context for what is occurring right now in our, what passes for a community, the tinfoil left, such as it is, or just, you know, the people that, you know, I interact with on Twitter. The two previous communities would be the UFO community in the past and the militia movement. And I mean that both were heavily infiltrated by out-and-out feds as well as propagandists for the far right, as well as occultists. Often, but not always, being one and the same, right? Different agendas for different points of view, but frequently overlapping. Now, my buddy Keith Allen Dennis, he introduced me to a term, the cultic milieu. This term was coined by an author named Colin Campbell. Campbell wrote a book entitled The Cultic Milieu, in fact. So the cultic milieu, as a concept, describes a fringe of rejected knowledge. Now I'm quoting Keith Allen Dennis here. The cultic milieu invites promiscuity on the part of its adherents. Come for the crystal hugging, stay for the flat earth stuff. We got breakout sessions over here for the pyramid idiots, another here for the quantum weirdos, and hey, over here we got your ray aliens. Hey, what's up with the swastika guys, etc. If one is already on the fringe, one is already among fellow fringe surfers busy hawking their own pet issues. Unquote. Now Keith, he compares the cultic milieu, and I think I might have cited this in another episode, and I love this metaphor. He says that the cultic milieu is like a pot of gumbo. And I'm obsessed with this concept, not least of which because I like gumbo, but also because it has great explanatory power, in my opinion. He said, again quoting Keith here, "I am convinced that there was a deliberate propagation of this cottage industry of rejected knowledge, and that longitudinal Cywar meme seeding was what it was all about. If you've got a malignant strain, like a QAnon cult tadpole, for instance, you can simply throw it in the gumbo, and just by being in the stew, it's going to attract and recruit for itself, because the inherent promiscuity of the cultic milieu will do that work for you. The old Rants.com website was the perfect example. You had cryptozoology here, fringe Egyptology there, all kinds of New Age stuff laying around all over, and embedded in it all is old John Birch Society guys ranting about the Federal Reserve. LaRouche was a regular guest. And hey, here's an essay on the enduring mystique of Hitler. Hey, again, what's going on with the swastikas, guys? What, WTF? Unquote. Now, I'm not trying to ruin the fun, non-Euclidean cutie. And, you know, I don't think it's bad to ask these questions. I personally do not think that there is a lot to the idea that space is not real. I have no plans to go into space, right? I'm not going to disprove it myself. I don't think that there's a lot to the idea that basic physics is not real, though I will certainly question the ontological framing of certain popular understandings of quantum physics at a minimum. But that said, I think there are certainly pointed questions that can still be asked about NASA and perhaps, say, general questions about the Van Allen radiation belts are certainly in order, if you catch my drift. You know, I'm not trying to ruin everybody's fun for everything. I do think that they're, just like Keith Allen Dennis said, this rejected knowledge idea is a gumbo, and it's been intentionally seeded, and I think that we've seen a lot of that pop off recently, so I don't see a lot of reason to throw stuff into the gumbo myself, and it certainly, if anything, taints some of the value that, you know, some of these ingredients might have. Like, who knows, maybe pyramids really are good, and if that were true, then it's being tainted by its exposure to the rest of the gumbo. Same thing with LaRouche shit. Like, Lord knows I cited LaRouche earlier with the Lincoln assassination. I doubt, personally, that the British Crown ordered Lincoln's assassination. I'm sure that maybe he's taking that a little bit too far. But my point being that even history like that can function as like rejected knowledge. And that is tough, man. Like, that sucks. Like, I'm always interested in counter history, counterfactuals, and stuff like that. And it doesn't do a service to any topic that you are personally interested in to have it stuck in this alternate weirdo gumbo, if that makes sense. Like, if it's good, it can stand on its own, and if it's bad, then it's just sort of relying on this milieu to, like, reach that critical mass, or, you know, like, at least survive in a certain sense. Bad, man. But thanks for listening again. I think these were great questions. Hopefully my answers were good. I know that typically my longer episodes are the more mind-blowing ones, but I still think this was fun. Hopefully people enjoyed it. Let me know, either way, what types of episodes you like to hear, because I like to provide what people actually want. I am assuming with Q&A questions, people did want their questions answered, so I assume that this is, you know, good. But yeah, just let me know. Thank you for listening, dear listeners. Just tell friends about the show. See you next episode, and God bless.